Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. A sweet tomato-flecked risotto with red main shrimp, nuggets of bacon, and a few artful tangles of wild arugula arrived as an appetizer. The bacon had heft and smoke and fatty crunch. It provided a fine complement to the tender flesh of the shrimp. Therefore, I rate the risotto a strong buy and set a price target of $18 by July. So reads only half of a review that was actually written by Sam Sifton of The Times. The part about the price increase just struck me as the next logical step if it were true that restaurant reviews affect prices. So that's the question. What's the value of a great restaurant review? That is a headline in the blog called Gastronomics, and that blog is written by Felix Salmon in New York Magazine. Salmon's also the finance blogger at Reuters and a bit of a foodie. Hello, Felix.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. So when you have an article that's under a headline like, what's the value of a great review? I, as an interviewer, am obliged to ask you, what's the value of a great review?
I knew you were going to do that.
Yeah.
It's good. If you're a restaurateur, it can do no harm and it can do a lot of good to have a great review because it brings new customers in and you're more likely to fill up your tables. And with restaurants, they have a lot of fixed costs, you know, rent and staff and that kind of thing. So they make all of their profit with those last few tables. And if you fill up those tables, then you make lots more money. So it's great for the restaurant to have a good review, assuming it brings in more customers. But from a customer perspective, it's actually not as mixed a blessing as you might think, because a lot of people assume that once the review comes out, a good review comes out, prices go up. And I did a bunch of number crunching on this, and while prices go up in all restaurants, you know, on a pretty regular basis, there's no real indication that they're more likely to do that after a restaurant has got a good review.
So good reviews do not inextricably lead to higher prices, even though the law of supply and demand would dictate that there'd be more demand to go to a restaurant. So why wouldn't they lead to higher prices?
Exactly. But on the other hand, if a restaurant is doing something right, if it's finally found a successful formula, it makes sense not to mess with that. You know, people like predictability, and I think you often find in the best restaurants that they time their price hikes relatively carefully. And so somewhere like, say, Gramercy Tavern or something like that will really be careful. They'll just do it like once a year or something like that, and they'll be predictable about it, instead of a lot of other restaurants which haven't quite got the formula down in the same way are messing around with the prices all the time. They're moving this bit up and that bit down, and they're trying to find the perfect sweet spot. It's not easy. It's much more of an art than a science.
And by the way, that you mentioned Gramercy Tavern. That happened to be where I pulled the risotto review that I read at the beginning of this segment. That was Sifton revisiting the Gramercy Tavern. So here's the question that I want to put to our listeners. When you read a rave review, do you brace for higher prices or do you just brace for harder to get reservations? And also, I'll ask a subset of that question, which is, where do you get your restaurant review knowledge from? Because I know the New York Times and New York Magazine, they, of course, have very famous reviewers, but now there are all these websites like Chowhound. Do you do a triangulation? Is there a formula that you use? You know, you weight some reviewers more than others. So how do you essentially decide that this restaurant is the kind of restaurant that seems like it has a lot of buzz around it? We're talking with Felix Salmon, who blogs for Reuters, blogs for New York Magazine, knows a lot about restaurants, and our number is 212-433-9692. 212-433-9692. Now, Felix, you know a lot of restaurateurs, and you've spoke with many of them over the years. And you know a lot of businessmen because you're a financial blogger. How do restaurateurs as businessmen differ from other kinds of businessmen?
That they're not quite as business savvy as a general rule. People often wind up opening restaurants because they love to cook or because they love hospitality and they like the idea of opening a restaurant. And what they don't tend to do so much is sort of see a great business opportunity and get funding for it and be terribly scientific and sort of MBA-like about it. So this is one of the reasons why restaurants often fail so much, is because they really don't have really clearly defined business plans before they open. And insofar as they do, there's so much variability, there's so much unpredictability in this business that all the best laid plans have to be tweaked very aggressively on a continual basis. There's a small handful of extremely professional restaurateurs. They often have a number of restaurants, you know, more than just one. They'll have like 4 or 5 or even 20. And those people tend to have more professional managers and have it much more down to a science and know exactly what they're doing. But your local neighborhood restaurant where the owner is the chef, is the host, you know, it's all, you know, keeping it very much in the family. They're not, they are businessmen, and they often, you know, businesswomen, and they often make decent amounts of money, but it's not the kind of profession that you'd really go into to make millions.
Right. It does strike me. I have noticed the same thing. They're not necessarily in the profit-maximizing game. I mean, except for huge chain restaurants, these aren't publicly traded companies that have shareholders to answer to. And in fact, I think restaurateurs think of themselves, or maybe not even consciously, but they think of themselves more like artists. Let's make enough money to pursue our passion, which is this restaurant, which brings me to your thesis and your study. If they were maximizing their profit, might it be smarter to raise prices after reviews more than we're seeing right now?
I think in the short term, yes. But in the long term, the way that you make real money in the restaurant business is through customer loyalty. And what you want is great local customers who are going to come back year after year after year, and who you know and who are regulars. And those people, you know, like it. They get offended if they've been coming, especially before, if they've been regulars even before the review came out. They kind of get offended if you open, if you raise your prices. It's weird from a diner perspective. You know, you don't really respect the idea that a restaurant is a profit-maximizing business. You know, again, it's this kind of friendly, you know, chef-owner relationship, human relationship, and you don't like to feel as though you're someone from whom, like, as much money as possible is being extracted each time you go to the restaurant. So over the long term, I think, you know, treating your diners with respect, giving them a great value, not trying to maximize the profit from every single meal, might make a little bit more sense.
Andy from Queens, welcome to WNYC. Go right ahead.
Yes. Hi, how are you, sir?
Very well.
I'm going. I have almost an insider look in this matter. I've been working in restaurants for 15 years now, so I used to get my reviews from the Zagat before the Zagat like got really famous, and I realized that even the Zagat, after about 10 years, they started really getting loose on the quality of reviews. Nowadays, when I read online, I can see that there are a lot of pissed off reviews. I don't know if I can say that, but, and it's hard to be objective. Me, as a, I've been a waiter and a manager in a restaurant for 15 years. I can see that most of the reviews really pertain to a single experience that the diner had, as opposed to what a restaurant does. And they're really hard to like, distinguish in between, especially since nowadays you get hundreds of reviews for every single restaurant that you can find online in different websites.
So are there any prominent reviewers that you, as an insider and someone who worked as a restaurant, have noticed over the years, hey, this guy's taste or this guy's take or this woman's take sort of lines up with what I think and what I know about the restaurant?
It's, yeah, but it's very hard to actually, because you don't know any of the reviewers personally. Everything is anonymous online. So my strategy is always to take, you go to the website that has like most reviews for the restaurant you're looking at, and you really have to skim through everything, or at least like get a general picture of what all those 160 people said to get an idea. Because if you read the first 10, you might find that like 5 of those are good, 5 are bad. But if you keep reading, you see that totally overall 9 out of 10 reviews will be good reviews for a restaurant. So you can differentiate between people who write about a single experience and people who write about the general atmosphere that a restaurant gives or serves food with, everything, you know, because food is service, decor, everything.
Got it. Thank you for the call, Andy, and we are asking for your calls on how you use reviews, and when you see a good one, What do you brace for? Our number is 212-433-9692. 212-433-9692. Felix Salmon, did you look into Yelp or other online sites and how that affect prices?
I didn't look into how they affect prices, but there has been some very interesting research when it comes to those Yelp reviews and similar, saying, and your caller is exactly right, there's a lot of selection bias in those reviews. People tend to write reviews when they feel strongly about something and not when they just had another good meal.
Right, like if you go to Amazon and book reviews, there are always one-star review and five-star reviews and very rarely exactly. reviews in between, yeah.
But the research has shown, interestingly, that the way people behave when they read these reviews, and people are more likely to go to restaurants where the reviews are well written. This is kind of unintuitive, and it's a very fascinating piece of research. It doesn't actually matter whether the reviews are good or bad. So long as the reviews are grammatical and spelled correctly, you're likely to consider the restaurant more attractive and you're more likely to go there.
So if you hated a as a user, if you hated a restaurant and want to tell someone not to go there, you shouldn't write in florid language expressing your innermost feelings about it. You should just have subject verb misagreement, and then that will drive
exactly.
people away.
That's exactly right. If you write, you know, a long disquisition in beautiful prose about how atrocious your meal was, people will likely like that, and they'll wind up going to the restaurant.
I wonder if the same is true for reviewing books. You know, a good book review poorly written is worse than a bad book review well written.
The other thing which I wanted to say very importantly is when it comes to places, that thankfully we've moved on from the gruesome days of Zagat monopoly of New York City, because the one place where Zagat was really, really bad was on prices. They would give you these completely fictional numbers about how much a meal was meant to cost with a drink and a tip. Half of the time it was physically impossible to spend that little money. They were always massively too low. And nowadays, with menu pages and other pages, places like that, you can get a much better idea of how much you're going to spend. Because often, the worst part of any meal is when you get the check and you're like, how much? And that's a horrible feeling. And even a good restaurateur doesn't want you to feel that way.
It's funny that you say that about Zag. It's because I work for NPR, and when I travel, you know, that you could submit a receipt for your meal. And the internal guidelines is meals should cost no more than $20. And in parentheses, they cite Zagat's as saying that in New York and D.C., you know, all the average price of a meal is $20. So what you're saying is true, but that's a fictional price. Yes. I love Ryan Sutton, Bloomberg's restaurant critic, who launched thepricehike.com. He just kind of chronicles every time a restaurant raises a price or even lowers it.
No one could be that industrious. He's a hardworking chap, but he's not superhuman. Now, he basically takes what you might call the top tier of restaurants, right, especially the ones with multi-course tasting menus. And when he notices a price hike, or when like his readers notice one, they'll let him know and he'll write about it. And some of them are huge. Some of them can be like 40% if the price goes up. That just happened down at Boulay in Tribeca. And there's no indication on the website that this has happened. And when you call up a reservation, they don't tell you that they just raised their prices by 40%. And then you turn up, and then it's too late, and then you feel upset.
And why it's really extra great is you don't just find out that the soup in Milo's or Milo's or however they pronounce that restaurant now costs $135, which is true, by the way. But Ryan Sutton's an actual journalist, so if you go on thepricehike.com, he always tries to get the people who make the prices on the phone and explain. And often there is an explanation about ingredients, and often that explanation has to do with black truffles.
And often, well, I mean, I would say 100% of the time when you get a restaurateur on the phone, you say, why did you raise your prices? They always say, oh, it's increased food cost, which cannot possibly be the explanation 100% of the time. It's just it's the socially acceptable reason to raise prices. So I'm not clear how much I believe those reasons, but at least, you know, you get them on the record.
Right, because studies have also shown that if you give an explanation for anything, people are usually satisfied. I wanted to ask you a bigger, maybe broader question. In in your experience, how much is the price consciously or subconsciously already factored into the review? I mean, it seems like I read reviews and I know the reviewer himself isn't paying, and sometimes it just seems separated from how much things cost. So they aren't saying this was good but not worth it. They're just saying this was good or this was bad. So what do you know about that? How much prices affect the reviews going in?
There are two different factors going on here. On the one hand, you're absolutely right. The sort of more high-minded reviewers at the grander publications, and I have definitely seen this at the New York Times, tend to just think, I am going to review the restaurant. And, you know, a bit like someone would go to review the opera, and they don't mind, they don't really think about the fact that their opera ticket costs $250 a seat. They're just going there to review the opera and tell you whether it's good or whether it's bad. Other reviewers, and New York Magazine is quite good at that, do take price into account, and they say, well, you know what? This is a good restaurant, but it costs how much? And this is important when you're rating a restaurant. But the other thing which happens is that when you go to a restaurant with very high prices, that primes you to expect something good. If you get a tiny little bowl of soup or something and it costs $25 for that tiny little bowl of soup, then you're thinking, oh, wow, this must be, you know, full of flavor and amazing. Whereas if you've got the same tiny little bowl of soup in a little cafe around the corner and it costs $3 or $4, you wouldn't have that kind of expectation, and so you wouldn't probably think of it as being so amazingly great. And so the prices, weirdly, especially in places like Gordon Ramsay at the London, which doesn't get great reviews but has incredibly high prices, the prices serve as a way of sort of reassuring the customers and indeed the reviewers that they're getting something really great. It must be good if it costs this much.
That is sort of marketing 101. The more you charge, the more people perceive that something is valuable, up to a point, of course.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I do notice, though, that some reviews of movies and reviews of Broadway shows don't take the price into account, but reviews of travel and reviews of hotel always do. So when you read a review that doesn't take the price into account, I always think, oh, this reviewer or his audience conceptualizes restaurants more like art. And when I read reviews that do take it into account, they conceptualize it more like a commodity, a luxury, that sort of thing.
Absolutely right. And frankly, eating should be a pleasurable, fun thing which you consume. It's not art. And, you know, much as people love to charge $150 a head for a 10-course tasting menu, you know, Okay. Food is still not art. And it's something where people go to have great conversations
Yep. And
a pleasurable.
Speaking of great
experience.
Conversations, I have to end it. Felix Salmon, thank you very much.